Thanks so much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to the show. Hope you enjoy yourselves. Wendy, you're taking some blame for something that I don't think is your fault.
Good morning, by the way.
Hi, good morning to you, by the way.
I really feel responsible for the Blackhawks' loss last night.
Why do you say that?
I haven't been
because you didn't score any goals?
Yes.
Well, you're not expected to. You're a viewer, a watcher.
A witness.
A witness,
if
you will.
Can I get a witness?
Can I get a witness?
Yes, I went to the game last night in the David Hochberg suite, so thank you to David Hochberg for helping me out. Not only is he a friend, he has helped me refine.
During the game in the David Hochberg suite, do they post scores from other games and NMLS numbers from other realtors? Like, are they constantly updated throughout the game? That's what I imagine happens.
No, but now if he's listening, he will do that from
yeah,
now on.
Yeah.
He was a great host. It was, you know, seeing Jonathan Toews make that first goal, I felt very confident.
Sure.
And John Williams was in the suite as well, and we were discussing it, and he wasn't as confident. I just really thought it was going to happen, but it seems like every game I go to, we're on the short end of the hockey stick.
Oh, no.
Either that or
really?
Something major happens when I go to the bathroom. Like,
something,
you know,
major on the good side or on the bad side?
Usually on the good side.
Well, then you need to go to the games and just sit in the bathroom.
That's what my sons told
Bring
me.
Bring a transistor radio and just sit in a stall and enjoy the game.
That's exactly what my sons said to me.
Problem solved. It's so easy.
Like, Mom, you can come with us, but you got to spend the game in the bathroom.
Right.
Because the last game we went to, there were like two goals in 3 minutes or something on our side. And I came back and they ended up losing.
Oh.
It's like, I just feel, you know.
You can't feel that way. It has little to do with you.
I know.
You're just there.
And I felt bad because I didn't see urgency last night on the ice.
I only got to see part of it on television, including the last period and the very brief overtime. Wow,
what,
was that quick.
13 seconds?
Wow.
16 seconds?
Yeah, that was
too depressing.
Fast.
Thankfully, we left early, so I didn't feel like I missed anything.
But I know they had, because I studied up on the game, they had a rough early going, but then they really picked it up toward the end of the game. Like the first two periods, they didn't even have 20 shots on goal, right, in the first two periods combined.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah.
But the knuckleheads kept going, too.
Yeah.
Knuckleheads, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, it was just, and I know they want to win. I hate when people say, yeah, there was no pizzazz. They didn't want it bad enough. Oh, they want it bad enough.
I always hear that analogy. The winning team, they obviously wanted it more. Whoever won, that's the team that wanted
true.
It more. The Blackhawks want it.
They want it really badly.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but we got 1 point. It still could happen.
Honestly, I know the win was a better move. I know the 2 points is with the goal there, but they were lucky to get the 1 point. That last-minute goal really solved the problem there.
So technically, last night's game was not a must-win,
no.
correct? Okay, because you hate when people say that.
No.
When it's not.
The only time a game is a must-win game, a true must-win game, not what the world of sports tell you is a must-win game, because they're just trying to sell you the excitement of the moment. But if the team loses and then they're done, they're eliminated, that's a must-win game. No. Yesterday was not a must-win game.
Okay, you make me feel hopeful
again.
Yeah. It was great to see Jim Thome out there. He got to do the honorary puck drop as they celebrated him.
How's Jim Thome looking?
Awesome.
Yeah. He's a wall, isn't he?
He is a wall. He's giant. He's sturdy.
Yes.
He's the sweetest man in the world, everyone says.
Yeah. But he could crush you.
Yes.
But just by
your neck like a chicken bone.
If he tapped you on the shoulder, he could crush you if he wanted to. He's got that option. He's so strong.
He is. It was great to see he and his wife sitting there.
What did he do exactly? What was his role?
He did the honorary puck drop.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. They saluted him.
Did the ice crack when he dropped the puck on the ice? Did the ice just crack in every direction?
No, but
I'm surprised.
It just cracks me up because, you know, the honorary puck drop, he drops the puck and then Toews and someone from the other team pretends to. I mean, I want to see a real face off there.
Yes.
But no.
But that would be dangerous for Jim Thome.
And I was talking to Jay Blunk, the senior vice president of business operations over at the Chicago Blackhawks, and he said exactly what you said. He goes, Jim Thome, the nicest guy in the world, but he's a wall.
He is.
He's a ginormous wall.
if in Fenway Park, if the green monster, that giant wall in the outfield, ever for some reason falls down or goes away, Jim Thome could just stand there and you wouldn't notice the difference, except that Jim Thome is not green. I guess that would be the
one
indicator.
Unless it was St. Patrick's Day.
Right. For St. Patrick's Day, that would be an easy play.
And it was nice to see a lot of people, including my husband, Jimmy Mack, with the Hawks jersey and the White Sox baseball cap.
Yes.
Just in honor of Jim Thome, number 25.
Yes.
So that was cool.
Yes.
I just wanted to win.
They have had an interesting season. They really have had such an up and down season. There's times where you just counted them out going, well, this isn't going to happen. It's not meant to be. And then anytime you start to think that way, they resurge. They just, I don't know, they put it all together. This last streak, was it a 5-game streak until yesterday? Very impressive streak. They look good in pretty much every game. They look good last night. They came back strong last night, just not strong enough. And the overtime needs to be longer than 16 seconds.
I know.
I saw the puck drop. I saw the puck go in the net. I saw a lot of disappointed people. Just like within a flash of a second.
Including them. And that's why this is where my mother's side kicks in. Because it's like, what's in their head right now?
We had a streak,
and now it's hard to get past that.
Yes.
I mean, the skill, the talent is 100% there.
Without a doubt. You're starting to see a bunch of young players emerge. You know, you have the veterans that have been there for seasons and have been through Stanley Cups, and they know what they're doing. But the new wave of guys coming on is very impressive. They're going to be
it
good.
It really is.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
But
don't
my
blame yourself.
I guess I can't, but my recommendation is maybe they should do a little Candy Crush tonight. They play again Thursday. And just clear their minds. Don't think about hockey. Just come out fresh on Thursday.
Now, when you say that, you mean not during the game, the Candy Crush.
No. Just
afterwards,
tonight
go home and relax.
You know, I know you're training hard, but go have your favorite good meal, steak, lobster, crab legs, whatever that is.
Yes.
Get some proteins in you. And then do a little Candy Crush and don't think about anything. Get it out of your head.
Here's why I find your idea amusing. There's a story I read today. Do you know who Carlos Santana is, baseball player?
Oh, I thought you meant the musician, Carlos Santana.
No, different guy.
Oye Como Va.
Right, that guy. No, this is a totally different
what
Carlos
team?
Santana. Philadelphia Phillies. A story just came out today about how last year he was so fed up with the team losing, and he'd go in the clubhouse, and the guys were all playing Fortnite.
Oh.
So he decided, enough of this, the focus needs to be on baseball, not on Fortnite. So he destroyed a television set with a baseball bat, which was a subtle way of saying to the team, let's focus on baseball, and if things go well, we'll worry about Fortnite.
He's the Elvis of baseball.
He is. He's the Elvis Presley of baseball.
He was taking care of business, baby.
Every once in a while, I'll see something on TV, and I'll say, I wish I had the guts to take a baseball bat to this. Every time a Real Housewife of You Name Your City is yelling at another Real Housewife, I go, I wish I had that kind of gall to just take a baseball
gumption.
Bat. Gumption and gall. Mornings, Q101. but Carlos Santana is a man of his convictions. He sees something he doesn't like, he puts an end to it.
But I don't like that either. That's some anger issues.
It seems very violent, doesn't it?
I think we need anger management training.
For Carlos Santana.
Do they have that in Fortnite?
No, there's no anger management training in Fortnite. All right, let's take a break. If you want to jump in, we would love to hear from you. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. All right, you're going to have to explain this to me, because even though I am the father of twins, I didn't know this. There's a woman in Texas that gave birth to 6 babies in 9 minutes. So if you have 6 babies, that is sextuplets, correct?
Right.
All right. It's one baby is a solo baby, 2 babies is twins, 3 is triplets, 4 is quadruplets, 5 is septuplets.
No, that's quintuplets.
Quintuplets.
6 is
sextuplets.
Septuplets.
Septuplets. Wait.
No, that's 7.
Yeah, 7, right?
You're right.
8 is octuplets.
Right. 9.
9 is a mess. Once you get to 9 babies, something ain't right. Stop having so many babies.
Mama had 9 babies.
And all their heads popped off.
I never heard that nursery rhyme.
All right, so I didn't realize, sound effects impersonated. I didn't realize that you could be a sextuplet and also be a twin at the same time. Did you know this? Because it says that this mom gave birth to 6 babies in 9 minutes. three sets of twins.
I know how that happens.
How does that happen?
Well, first of all, when you have identical twins, which you don't,
right.
You have one fertilized egg and it splits into two.
Yeah. Okay.
So if an egg is dropped from the ovary and it's fertilized and it splits into two, that's a set of identical twins. Then if another errant egg gets out there,
yes.
That is its own baby, although it can all be in the womb at the same time.
Okay.
You look completely more confused.
It's easier for me to just nod and say okay than it is to do the math on that. So you can obviously you can be both a sextuplet and a twin, as these children are. And how do they determine this?
All right, here's where I just cannot believe my own theory.
All right.
And perhaps an OBGYN can call in.
Mm-hmm. Or OBGYN on WGN. That's a show I proposed to the program director, and the assistant program director quickly quit. She said, I'm out. I'm not putting up with this. I will go elsewhere.
Please. So if you have sextuplets and they're all identical, like the Goslings weren't identical.
From John and Kate Plus 8?
Yeah. So, but there were like a large grouping of babies that were identical, weren't they? Or have they all not been? Because how can one egg split into six pieces?
I don't know the answers to any of these
questions.
I need
a geneticist. Stats!
Yes, quickly. If you're a geneticist, I should know this because I have twins myself, but I don't.
But here's the your twins, two eggs came down and they were fertilized by Superman.
Yes. Yes.
I just gave you a compliment.
Thank you.
And then so those two babies grew in the same womb, but they were different eggs and different.
Separate.
Yes.
Right.
Separate entities.
Right.
An identical twin is one egg drops down from the fallopian tube and goes, whee!
Yeah.
In what looks like the...
Like a crazy straw.
No, it looks like the Dodge Ram logo if you look at uterus and the fallopian tubes.
So that's what the Dodge Ram logo is. I didn't know that, Wendy. Wow. Thanks for sharing that with us.
It really looks like it. Sorry, Dodge.
No, it does.
So one egg would drop down, it gets fertilized, and then it splits in two, so there are two separate entities, but it came from one same zygote.
Yes.
So that's why they're identical.
Okay. All right.
So if she had six, then maybe how many sets of twins?
Three sets of twins.
So three eggs split.
So where and how do they know that? Like, at what stage of the pregnancy or the birth did they determine, in all three of these cases, that it was three sets of twins?
Well, first of all...
they don't know that... Do they know that upon arrival, as the babies are being delivered, do they determine that? Or is that something you already knew going in?
Why do you ask me these things?
I'm just curious.
I think when the babies come out and two look alike, they go, oh.
No, that can't be right.
Well, when you get an ultrasound... Typically, you're somewhere around 6 weeks, because a lot of times you don't even know you're pregnant when you are.
Right.
And the ultrasound, I don't know if you can tell at that early time if the egg, I mean, you can see if there are two entities growing, but I don't know if you can determine whether or not it split from the same cell. Oh, is your OBGYN calling you?
Yes, my OBGYN is calling.
Did you miss your last appointment?
My last two appointments. They're not happy with me at the office. There's people on the line who can help us, Wendy.
Oh.
That's the beauty of the
All
station.
All right, because we don't have a lot of time, but hopefully Mary can put an end to this craziness that we have going on. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Okay, you guys are, unfortunately, I think you're making it more exciting than it is. In all likelihood, this was IVF.
In vitro fertilization. I'll help the novices out there.
Okay, yep. Three fertilized eggs were transferred at the blastocyst stage, early in embryonic development.
Yeah.
They were transferred into the uterus, so they knew that they had transferred three embryos.
Got it.
And then each of those split. And so that's how you would know just right away. You didn't transfer six embryos. You transferred three embryos, and you ended up with six. So,
Mary, you're a genius.
I really am.
Are you in the field, or are you just a novice?
Yeah. No, I'm in the field.
Okay, explain this to me then, too. Are there ever, like, multiple births where they all look alike, where an egg could split that many times?
No.
Okay.
An egg can split. There are identical triplets.
Okay.
And often naturally occurring triplets. Well, I shouldn't say often. It's not that common, but there are identical triplets out there where the egg splits in three. But generally, when you have triplets, even it's either three eggs, or it was a three embryo transfer if it was an in vitro fertilization, or it's one egg splits and the other egg doesn't, and so that makes three. The ways you can get to the math.
What's the highest you could go with identical babies? Is three the absolute highest, or could you go higher?
I can't say for sure. As high as I've heard is triplets, but I suppose you could probably have quads, but I think, you know, it gets less and less likely each time.
All right.
And what does it mean when you open an egg, you crack an egg, and there are two yolks in it? Would that have been identical chicken babies, twins?
I'm unfortunately not an agricultural specialist.
Oh, so,
all right.
Orion.
No. All right.
All right.
Well, Mary, right. That would be Orion.
Mary,
thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
All right. I'll be in for my appointment on Wednesday. She hung up quickly.
Yes. Quick break. News time. Oh, no. There is no break.
Nope.
And your first ultrasound is between 18 and 20 weeks.
Your first what, Mary?
Ultrasound.
Oh, it is.
You guys were talking about
Oh.
That. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Don't they typically put multiple embryos in because they don't always hold even one of them, but this was a miracle that all three held?
Yes. It seems, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
She's got a good uterus.
I think she must. Yeah, she must.
That's all pretty right. impressive.
That's a weird compliment to throw out, but yeah.
But it's also like I planned for one, maybe two babies, and now I have six.
And now there's six. You go from 0 to 60 very fast. Yeah.
When I was pregnant with my first one, Michael, Jim would always get me water. Anytime like I have Braxton Hicks contractions, can I get you some water?
Yeah.
That was his answer for everything.
Yeah.
And I found myself saying, you to man, and he would always say, uterus.
That's beautiful.
That's when our
That's
love
so
blossomed even more.
Yeah. Jen, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill Leffin. It's Wendy Snyder. How can you reach us? Well, 312-981-7200 usually does the trick. You can call us there. You can text us there.
I can't believe you said that while cabbage patching.
Yeah, I did. I was able to do both. Did you enjoy that?
Yes.
I'm all sweaty now.
I like your parachute pants,
Oh, thank
too.
You, Wendy. Thank you. I know that anytime you and I discuss politics, either in short form or in long form, people get very, very upset. Hey, leave the politics out of it. Hear me out.
And we typically do. Unless right. something's in the news.
Right.
You know.
Right, right, right.
I'm no wonk.
You're not.
No.
I was under the impression you were. If they have your business cards changed now. All right. So just hear me out. Because even though the origin of this story is political, it won't end up politically, probably. There's a man named George Conway who has been less than kind to our current president. George Conway on Monday said that about President Trump, that we should be thinking seriously about his mental condition and his psychological state. He has, from time to time, taken similar blasts about the president. So you say, well, what's the big deal about that? Let this guy, George Conway, speak his mind. He is the husband of Kellyanne Conway, the White House advisor. So my question is this. How exactly does that work? If one person in a marriage or a partnership has very, very clear and definite feelings about something politically, and your feelings are the exact opposite, as seems to be the case with George Conway and his wife Kellyanne Conway, how can the two of you coexist together in a house? I don't know how you pull that off. Good for them if they can do it. They seem to be able to manage it fine. I just don't know how you do it.
I certainly don't either. It would be, I don't know. I just think, you know, when you marry someone, you have your differences, of course.
Without a doubt.
But your core goals, I believe, are the same.
Sure.
I know that we talked about this off the air. I couldn't remember their names. So James Carville and Mary Madeline.
Yes.
They have been together since 1993.
And are polar opposites when it comes to politics.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I looked something up, and both Madeline and Carville have gone on record saying they do not talk politics at home.
You would almost have to establish that as a bylaw,
yes.
Wouldn't you? Because
it's in the marital contract. Part you know of your vows.
Right. That must be included in your vows. You know how during the holidays, you and I discussed this, that with Thanksgiving and then later Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, you're going to be together with a larger family unit than you're accustomed to. It's not just the people in your immediate family. It's your extended family. And odds are there's going to be some differences of opinion when it comes to politics. So how do you handle that during the holidays? Do you make a law saying, hey, we're all going to come in and enjoy the holiday together and there'll be no discussion of politics, or we'll discuss it, but if things get a little too heated, we'll have to sidetrack and go a different way? I get that when you're in an extended family and you're only going to see them for a few hours on a holiday, but when you're married to somebody or living with somebody and they're your life partner, quote unquote, I cannot figure out.
I can't either.
I know there's people who do it, and I applaud you for being able to do it. I don't think I could do it.
And have things changed in this time? Like I said, 1993 was the year that James Carville and Mary Madeline got married.
Mm-hmm.
The atmosphere is different now. Do they still not talk politics at home?
I wonder if because now they're not as much in the,
that's true.
For them particular, they're not so much in the game. I see both of them show up on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. I see them show up there, but they're not in the trenches right now. But with Kellyanne Conway, she's right in the thick of things. And her husband, every week, every other week, makes some statement questioning, you know, Donald Trump. So what happens when she reads? Oh, she must know it at some point during the day. She either reads it, she finds out about it. So what happens when they get home? Do they even discuss that? They'd have to, right?
Well, 630 has texted us. I think Kelly really puts on a good show, but doesn't truly believe what she is really saying. I don't know if that's true. Someone also commenting, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Maria Shriver, one liberal journalist from a liberal, highly political family, the other staunch conservative who became governor of California. But the rest of the story is they are no longer married, but they didn't
right.
split up because of politics.
No.
I believe a mistress was involved.
Yes.
My guess is, this is 208, my guess is that the Conways are close enough to politics to know it's mostly a load of BS anyway, and therefore it's not that big of a deal to them. That could be true.
I'd like to think that that's true. That makes it more palatable. With religion, like you can marry somebody of a different religion. I saw this firsthand with my parents.
Yep.
My dad's Jewish, my mom was Catholic.
And neither converted, correct?
Neither converted. So, like, going into it, they just said, yeah, we respect you, whatever your religion is. We totally respect it. Whatever you want to do, do. That's fine. No reflection on me. Have at it, you know?
And that stayed true.
That stayed true forever. And I know a bunch of other people since then who are of different religions, and, you know, they just go, yeah, okay, that's fine. Whatever. But with politics, it seems... You would almost think the religion angle would be more heated than the political, but it's not that way anymore.
Although anymore, how do we know what's going on right now? I know of what we know in the past, and they've been able... I mean, I don't understand how Cubs and Sox fans can be married. So, I mean, and that's so minor.
But you know that on average, like, if you just have some sort of a get-together with four people or six people or eight people, politics is going to come up. Religion can, but it just seems like religion is just way back in the corner somewhere. Like, you're just sitting with people around a dinner table, you probably won't believe or bring up the religious differences. But just because politics is just permeating everything that goes on, that's probably going to come up.
That's true, because when I was little, I guess I was mainly hanging out with my family when I was really little, and they were all Catholic. But religion was something you kept to yourself, and in a way, politics was too.
Yeah.
That has changed, Bill.
Yeah.
That's what the problem is.
Yep.
Can't we all just get along?
Wouldn't that be nice? All right, it's Tech Tuesday. We'll talk to Bridget Carey from CNET in just a little bit.
Oh, you know what that music means? It means it's a Tech Tuesday here on the Bill and Wendy Show. And sitting in for Bridget Carey this week is senior editor over at CNET TV, Ashley Esqueda. How are you, Ashley?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
Great. Saw some stories that we're going to cover today. And I know a lot of people have kids that are athletes. Some of us have kids that are more into video games, but that might not be a bad thing. What's going on?
Might not be a bad thing anymore. I mean, I wish this happened when I was in high school, because I probably would have done it. I probably would have varsity lettered in video games.
How about this? It's a sport now, isn't it?
It is a sport now in high schools. I mean, we're familiar with esports. You may have caught an esports competition on ESPN or Disney XD. Now it's moving down into the high school circuit. So there are a few states that started participating in high school esports last year, and now more states are getting on board, including Texas Charter High Schools, and a few other states. And so the idea is that you'd be able to put together a team for your high school, and you'd be able to compete in competitive games that are approved by the high school for a varsity letter. You can actually letter now in video games, which is pretty amazing. So, esports is just such a huge industry, and it's only getting bigger.
What are the sports, Ashley? Do we know yet?
So one of the games is called Smite, and it's about kind of like gods and monsters. But I have a feeling we're going to be seeing, it'll be really interesting to see how this kind of plays out, because there's a lot of corporate money in esports, and there are very specific games in esports. So it's not just like basketball, where every time you play it, it has the same rules, and this is how you play. You've got Fortnite, which is a huge phenomenon right now. If you've got kids between the ages of, 5 and 25, they're probably playing Fortnite. And then you've got a brand new games like Apex Legends. You've got games like Overwatch, Call of Duty. There are a lot of games like that. So I have a feeling, obviously, they're going to want to keep it friendly for that age demographic. So games that are rated M for mature, probably scrapped. But we might see games like Overwatch show up in high school esports, which, who knows? I mean, I think the sky's the limit there. And I think, there's also a possibility a game developer may make a game specifically for high school competition, which would be very interesting. If it rolls out across the country, I could very easily see a game developer saying, hey, you know what? Let's make a game specifically for high school esports.
I don't know if this is a good thing, because already you're trying to get your kids off the computer, and now it's like, hey, I'm practicing.
Right.
It's so true. I mean, look, that would have been my excuse.
Me too.
Ashley, well,
I played esports professionally for a year way back in the day when it was just starting out. Unreal Tournament was the game that I played, and I had a very fun year of playing professionally and traveling a little bit, and now I'm like, wow, that would have been a career path for me had it happened today. But at the time, it wasn't really widely available, and people didn't really get it.
Will colleges recruit these high school athletes, and how will this affect things at Lori Loughlin's house and Felicity Huffman's house?
Oh, Olivia Jade might start playing Overwatch, guys.
Wouldn't that be nice?
But there are scholarships, aren't there, Ashley? There are scholarships to colleges for this, right?
There are. UC Irvine has a pretty robust esports program that they have been piloting for a couple of years. They have an esports arena on campus that is absolutely beautiful, all state-of-the-art computers. And the idea is, there's not a lot of kids, a lot of teenagers. There is an actual sort of split between kids whose families can afford these high-end PCs to be able to play these games competitively and kids who can't. And so, part of this is that, the high schools are saying, well, we want everybody to be able to compete. So we have these, partnerships with maybe an outside esports arena that's local to the high school, or, maybe high schools someday will start building them on campus. But there is some goal there to sort of bridge the gap between, kids who have a little bit of privilege in being able to afford these thousands of dollars computers and be able to actually compete in these leagues, and kids who don't have that. And so, so that's actually a good thing that may come out of this.
I'm kind of torn between this. My boys are not into athletics at all. One's into a videographer. One's a musician. So if you have a kid who's not an athlete, they're not able to participate. So I kind of like this end of things. And computers, I mean, if they're buying these really expensive computers, they're probably also going to learn how to fix them. And that's just moving into the future.
That's very true. And also there are a lot of peripherals that allow, you know, disabled gamers to play.
Oh,
and so we haven't seen a lot of gamers with accessibility challenges playing in professional esports leagues. But I would argue that with, you know, with technology, it actually gives them at least an opportunity, accessibility wise. I mean, these are sort of things that, you know, are a little, they're certainly out there. I mean, you can find programs, but there are certain gamers or certain people who cannot participate in any kind of physical activity, and this is an avenue for them to try to do something competitive, and I think that's really cool.
One of our listeners wants to know if there's going to be a vaping club as well pretty soon.
Oh, that would be great.
Oh, God. Hopefully not. Hopefully they save that for college. Hopefully we save the vaping clubs for college.
Has somebody already copyrighted the term e-fleets, or should I jump on that?
E-fleets, you know, you should. You could jump on it.
I'll jump on it.
I think that that's the abbreviation for that's a new abbreviation.
All right.
I know they're referred to as e-sports athletes, but yeah, go for it.
All right,
it.
I'm on it. Gotta go. Bye, Wendy.
E-fleet is already in the Urban Dictionary. So
every time I think of something.
And yes, a description of an individual that only participates in online or video sports. Sorry, Bill.
You were so close.
All right. So medicine, the world of medicine is going to change because there are digital smart pills. What in the world is this?
This is terribly interesting and something that medicine has been working on for a while. So we've heard of things like nanobots that we use, that science is trying to use to do things like attack certain antibodies or certain diseases or infections in your system. And now we have these digital pills. And so the idea is that there is a chip inside of a pill that you would take. And in one particular case, the pill tracks whether or not you take your medication every day. It tracks how effective the medication is inside your system, which is pretty interesting stuff. But there are, you know, and it sounds pretty good, especially, you know, a lot of people, and I forget the percentage, but it's quite a bit of people either don't fill their prescriptions or take their medication improperly or forget to take their medication in the case of a lot of elderly patients. And so this would offer an opportunity for caregivers and or patients themselves to sort of get notifications. Maybe, you know, your provider sees that you have not taken your cholesterol medication. And so they send you a text message through your app, through your provider's app that says, hey, you haven't taken, you should take your cholesterol medication. You haven't taken that yet. But flip side of that is of course, insurance companies, I'm sure, would love to have that information
so
that they can raise your rates. You didn't take your cholesterol medication. That's not good. Like, now you got to pay more. And so, you know, I think that there's definitely some privacy concerns there. And a lot of patients, you know, just want to get better, and they don't want to share that data with their doctor.
Yeah. HIPAA
there's
laws.
And also we do see a lot of, that's a really great point, which is we see a lot of things get breached security-wise. Yeah. We see a lot of data get dumped on the internet. I mean, Equifax dumped the data of almost every credit-holding American when it got hacked. And so this is a really kind of scary, but it's one of those things that it's the forefront of biomedicine. This is kind of new stuff that's happening right now, but there also has to be a conversation about how do we use this data? How do we protect this data? It's very important to protect it. And also, how do we protect our patients, not only from people who would use that information in a bad way? So, for example, if you were to hack that information, maybe hackers would be able to get a prescription that they couldn't get before. They would use your data to sort of steal your identity and have prescriptions made, or and then sell that on a black market. Or on the flip side of that, how do we protect our patients from things like premium increases for insurance providers? Because, you know, the thing is we've seen some programs at work that say, oh, you get an incentive for being healthy. So if you jog, or if you have a smartwatch, we can track how many steps you take every day, and you get a bonus to your health care or whatever. But penalizing people might become a little bit more of a problem.
Pretty interesting. Yep. We should stay tuned.
To think about.
Yep. Ashley, great job as always. Thanks for joining us. Have a great rest of the week.
You too. Bye, guys.
Ashley Escada, senior editor at CNET. Go to CNET.com. Right now, coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN Radio.
Appreciate it. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And we are in March, and March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. We have Dr. Scott A. Strong, Chief of Gastrointestinal Surgery in the Digestive Health Center at Northwestern Medicine with us today. Hi, Dr. Strong. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. I'm fine.
All right. We were talking off the air. Colon cancer, what are the stats on this? Is it a very common cancer?
It's actually the third leading or most common kind of cancer in men and women. So it follows lung in both, and then comes after prostate in men and breast cancer in women. So this year in the United States, we estimate there'll be about 145,000 cases of colorectal cancer diagnosed.
But one of the more treatable of all cancers.
Absolutely.
Right?
At least 2/3 of individuals that present with colorectal cancer will ultimately be cured of their cancer. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those more favorable cancers compared to lung.
Right.
Okay, so we were talking off the air. Obviously, people need to get a colonoscopy. Let's just get it out there right now. It's not fun. You were very concerned about your colonoscopy.
I'm what they call a baby.
A baby.
Right? I don't know if you've ever heard that term, but I'm a scaredy cat, a baby. And everybody always said, no, with this, you won't even know what they did. You'll go in, and then they'll wake you up, and they'll say, it's time to leave. And I'll go, oh, no, you're sugarcoating it. It's exactly how it played out. Couldn't have been easier.
But the prep is what people complain about.
Yeah, so I think all three of us have been through this.
Yeah.
And the prep is not the easy part. But the colonoscopy, the intent is for it to be a very safe and comfortable examination, and that's what we all try to do, and for the most part, we're successful in that.
Okay, so when you, I don't want to phrase it that way, when you get in there, if there is something that looks suspect, is it treatable right then and there with a colonoscopy? Is this some way to prevent colon cancer from happening? How does this work?
Yeah, so there are several of the cancers that your family doctor will recommend that you get screened for on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And depending on the cancer, the screening starts at different ages, and the interval between the tests varies. With colon cancer, in the past, we always said at the age of 50 years, whether you're having any kind of symptoms or not, that you get a colonoscopy or some kind of screening done.
And male and female.
Yeah. It starts at the same age, and then it follows every 10 years thereafter if nothing abnormal is found. Just in the last year, the American Cancer Society has come out and said, in response to some recent information, that we're seeing colorectal cancer occurring in more younger individuals than what we had in the past, that they lower that screening age to 45 now.
Really?
And so now we're recommending that it happen every 10 years, beginning the age of 45 until the age you're 75. And if you're in pretty decent health at that time, it goes on to 85. But then we're not recommending screening after the age of 85.
No, because why?
Just because of if you look at the average life expectancy of someone at 85, and if they are not having any kind of issues at 85, that likely they would
not have problems. What do you think is behind the moving the age lower to 45? Why are younger people getting it all of a sudden?
We really don't know that. I mean, we know there are certain risk factors, and they're risk factors that you can't manage, and that includes your sex, not really, as far as male, female is pretty comparable there.
Yeah.
But
is it hereditary?
It can be. And so it's hereditary, which you can't change. Your ethnicity or race has some kind of influence. We see it in African Americans about a little bit, 5, maybe 10 years earlier in onset. If you have type 2 diabetes, we can't change that. If you have something called inflammatory bowel disease, that puts you at increased risk.
So an increased risk if you're a diabetic?
Diabetes 2.
Oh, so. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then this, as we get older, our risk increases. And then there are things that you can manage. Smokers are at increased risk for colorectal cancer. We know that if you're overweight or obese, it increases your risk. If you have a sedentary lifestyle, it increases your risk. Excessive amounts of red meat or processed meat increase your risk. And we don't know why this younger age group is experiencing increased risk, because we don't really see any of these factors at play, or that they couldn't have any kind of influence in such a short period of time that we've seen the change. So there's something that's going on that we don't understand. But
the median age of other cancers is also getting younger, and it's very scary to think that that's happening, not across the board, but in a lot of instances.
It is. And as I get older and I see patients now coming in that are much younger than I am, yeah, with colorectal cancer, it just gives you really pause to reflect on it.
You know what confuses me, as you mentioned, definitely quit smoking, lose weight, exercise regularly, eat better. A lot of the younger people are not smoking. A lot of them are eating better. They're exercising. They're in better shape maybe than we were when we were at that age. So that's what's confusing to me.
Yeah. So obviously there are things about the disease that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And is vaping a factor at all?
I heard your last session. I don't believe so.
Oh, I'm going to blame everything on vaping, just so you know.
Now, this came to the forefront years ago. It was in 1998. Katie Couric's first husband died of colon cancer. He was only 42 years old. So then Katie went on and basically allowed people to see her colon on TV to show this isn't such a bad thing. That probably helped a lot of people, because at 42, you think, oh my God, that's way too young to go. He had found this earlier. The success rate for curing colon cancer is pretty high, isn't it?
It is. So when we do these colonoscopies, and if you have a family history of someone under the age of 60 who had a colorectal cancer, then we actually recommend instead of age 50 that it begin at age 40, and it be done every 5 years instead of every 10 years. Or if you've had more than or two or more first-degree relatives, so a sibling or a parent with colorectal cancer at any age, or what we call an advanced adenoma, which are polyps that aren't quite cancer yet but have a propensity to go on to become cancer, that they begin this screening earlier in life and more frequently. And in some people, if you're 42 years of age, then we would say that your relatives need to start have screening at the age of 32 or 10 years younger.
Jeez.
But, with prostate cancer that we talked about before, we recommend these PSA tests for breast cancer, the mammograms. And those are all largely designed to detect a cancer at an early stage when it's more curable. And we do the same thing with colonoscopy, but it's not that common that we actually find a colorectal cancer with the colonoscopy, even though about 1 in 23 of us will have colorectal cancer during our lifetime. Instead, what we're actually, the benefit of something like colonoscopy is that we find polyps. And some of these polyps, certainly not all, but some, go on to become a cancer. And we can't differentiate easily which ones will and which ones won't. But anytime we see a polyp during a colonoscopy, we're able to remove it right then and there, getting back to your earlier question. And in doing that, we remove the precursor lesion, and we get you into a more frequent surveillance program. And with that, you can largely prevent cancer from developing.
That's amazing.
So the screening test, colonoscopy, not only is it a screen for cancers, but is also preventive. And so that's where it really has a leg up on a lot of the other ways that you could potentially be screened for this disease.
Do you then test one polyp, or do you test many polyps? How do you decide?
Yeah, any that we see, we typically remove.
You do?
And in removing them, they all get sent off to the laboratory and they look at them.
Yeah.
Do most people, I know you're not supposed to discuss other people's colons while we're on the air, at least.
Right. Wendy's been reprimanded more than once for that.
Do you find polyps more often than not? Does everybody have some kind of polyps?
Yeah, it depends on the age, but probably at least 1 in 3 of us have a polyp when we do have a colonoscopy done.
It was Katie Couric's husband, Jay Monahan was his name, and when that happened to him, I remember the part Wendy said where they said if only they had caught it a little bit earlier. That was the wake-up call to me.
Yeah, but if he had no symptoms,
yeah,
and the screening guidelines are what they are,
yeah,
there's no way to guess. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
And the bottom line is have a great relationship with your primary care physician, because I can't remember when you start 10 years minus someone in your family, but your doctor has your whole history and can hopefully suggest, hey, here's a prescription. Do you need a prescription to go get a colonoscopy?
Well, you need to be typically referred for it, because you have to have the prescription for the day before.
Oh, yeah, the fun drugs.
Yeah.
All right, we have to take a quick break. If you have any questions, and I would like to talk about symptoms too. I know, you know, those aren't pretty, but maybe there's something we can look for and learn something today. We've got Dr. Scott A. Strong in the studio with us, Chief of Gastrointestinal Surgery in the Digestive Health Center at Northwestern Medicine. You can go to nm.org and find out more. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. It's 720.
Scott Strong, MD, is with us, Chief of Gastrointestinal Surgery in the Digestive Health Center at Northwestern Medicine. And we know how Scott got his last name. He just shared a story with us. Scott, you had a colonoscopy and opted out on the sedation. You said, no, I'd like to be awake for this. What the huh?
Yeah, so, you know, many of us, when we have this done, we know what to expect as far as discomfort, and it's a little bit of cramping that you get. And if the endoscopist is a fairly skilled individual, you know, oftentimes you can do it without sedation. And if you're uncomfortable during the procedure, you can either ask for something, or they can change something, or just stop altogether.
But yeah.
Why would you not take the sedation?
Well, afterwards, so the sedation causes some amnesia, and for the rest of the day, you're told not to do anything that carries any type of legal responsibility and things like this.
Right.
And you can't. You need a driver to take you home, and
that's what Uber's for.
And
why didn't you just do your own colonoscopy? Why even?
You just did it to check on the person doing yours, didn't you?
Well, two sets of eyes is always better than one.
Sure, it is. So you didn't watch the procedure though, did you?
Oh, so
you did.
There's
so,
a little screen there.
Yeah.
So yeah. So like in Northwestern Medicine, we have actually two very large monitors in the room, and
looks like Pac-Man.
And so whenever we're doing the procedure, we actually have a nurse as well as a technician in the room, and everybody's watching the monitor. So and you know, there are times that you'll see a little, or one of them will see a little polyp that you can easily miss.
Oh.
And so actually it's three sets of eyes that are kind of looking at
things. That's a good
idea, then. Yeah. And it just, you know, and everybody kind of, you know, is working towards the same goal.
The day before, it's a clear liquid diet and various ways to eliminate things in your body. When I had mine, it was a long time ago, and they had these pills that you took, and I believe they have since been taken off the market.
Yeah, through the years, we've done a lot of different things, and people don't like the large volume of fluid that you need to drink, and it's not, they try to make it palatable, but with all respect to the companies that manufacture it, it's not the
it's
most
not.
Enjoyable, flavorful drink.
Right.
And so for a while, there were other things that you used, and you just had to drink a lot of fluid in addition, because either the fluid you drink just washes things out, in other words, none of the fluid is absorbed into your bloodstream. And then conversely, what you drink can cause you to have diarrhea, for the body to excrete a lot of fluid. And when they were using things like that, people weren't replenishing that fluid that they were losing. And so they're getting profoundly dehydrated.
Oh.
And some of the products are taken off the market because people are having problems with their kidneys.
Good God.
And so that's why we've kind of gone to what we've gone to with these kind of balanced solutions that nothing gets absorbed, nothing gets secreted,
right?
So you don't get dehydrated from the bowel preparation.
And no red Gatorade. That is something you cannot use, I was told.
Well, we just get confused when you see this red fluid.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Let's talk about some symptoms. If you're in reasonably good health and you're regular, any change to that might be a sign?
Correct. So you look for changes. And, you know, for screening is not triggered by a symptom. With the screening, we just want people coming in as we described
earlier.
Take
a look-see. That's
what
you got to do.
If you should notice that you're starting to experience bleeding or a change in your bowel habits that is, you know, goes on for several weeks, or you're getting pain, abdominal distension, weight loss that you can't explain, then those are all things that you should talk to your family doctor about.
What about these mail-in tests that people have seen? I don't know how exactly
Cologuard
you do
it. Cologuard is the name of the
company,
right?
Is that it?
Right?
Correct.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
So So Cologuard was created. In the past, we would use stool samples and look for traces of blood in that. And they had one that would, it was a little bit confusing because it would pick up other types of blood, like in red meat. So then they made one that was focused wholly on human blood. But the Cologuard actually looks for DNA in the stool, or and it, what the thought is that the cancer cells shed these cancer markers. And so what Cologuard does is it takes the sample of stool and it looks for these cancer markers that have been shed by the cancer, because the cancer grows inside or on the lining of the bowel.
Right.
So as the stool passes by, it can pick up cells and can pick up these markers. And so with in using this test, what we know is that it will detect about 92% of colorectal cancers.
Really?
And as far as kind of these polyps that are worrisome, it'll detect about 4 out of 10 of those.
So somebody who goes through this, if there's something worrisome, then they recommend that you go in for a full colonoscopy, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And so, but you have to remember that it is going to miss about 8% of cancers.
Oh.
And more than half of the worrisome polyps.
And this is done through the mail?
All they need is the sample.
Oh. Boy, it gives new meaning to junk mail, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. I am so embarrassed for you, Dr. Strong. I am really apologetic for you coming up today. That's good to know, but I almost feel like, you know, you want to get in and get out, so to speak.
Oh, there we go.
You really do, though. I mean, because if something's there, you've eliminated a step. You're there. You're getting it checked. A lot of insurances cover a portion of this.
Oh, most insurance companies will cover this type of screening for the colonoscopy test.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to say again,
I'm sorry.
You're going to get a fruit basket in the mail from me. I'm so afraid of anything medical. Any medical procedure scares the daylights out of me. And this was so simple and so easy. And I wish I had done it a couple years earlier. But I urge anybody who's on the fence, go do it. You need to do it. It could save your life.
Well, and it, you know, if you undergo the test and everything comes back fine, you can rest assured that for the next 10 years, you don't need to really basically worry about this.
Right. Right.
I'm making an appointment today.
Yep.
Just for the fun of it. I'm like, I haven't been in a while. I missed you.
Why isn't Colin Powell your spokesperson? He should be the spokesperson.
I got to let you go now. He's Scott A. Strong, MD, and Chief of Gastrointestinal Surgery in the Digestive Health Center at Northwestern Medicine. You can find them at nm.org, your office, 259 East Erie Street in Chicago. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you putting up with us.
Thanks, God.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
I'm sure it is.
Your fingers are crossed. I can see your fingers crossed. Thanks a lot. We'll take a break and then a lot more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
The lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Seriously, how can you not love Adam Levine? Listen to this guy. He's fantastic, Wendy. What's wrong with you? He's so good. Some sad news for those of you who frequent drive-ins.
I've been once.
Both of you, come closer to your radio if I tell you the sad news. The iconic Cascade Drive-In is closing its doors. Well, they don't have doors. They're a drive-in. They're closing their entryway after 58 years in West Chicago.
God.
One of the last surviving drive-ins pretty much anywhere.
Were you a frequent drive-in guy?
When I was a kid, we went during the summer months almost every Sunday for a triple feature.
Really?
At either the Bel Air Drive-In, the I-80 Drive-In. There were, we lived in an area where there were three of them. I'm trying to remember what the third one was. But yeah, we went pretty often.
I never went to a drive-in theater with my family as a kid. The first time I went was when I was dating Jimmy Mack. We went to see Waterworld. So that was...
You saw that in a drive-in?
Yes.
Did it make it better or worse?
I liked it.
Actually, it wasn't bad, was it?
It really wasn't.
Costner movie, Waterworld?
But I couldn't understand the whole concept of, you know, you could get out, you could bring lawn chairs and get out.
It was such an experience.
It's pretty cool.
It's so funny because really when you stop and analyze it,
you're getting a subpar movie experience.
Yeah, because it's hard to see the screen, really.
It's hard to see the screen. The sound system was terrible. They improved it a little bit.
Yeah, it was kind of just something like this. And, I mean, you could see the screen because it was big, but the picture on it was very light. It was hard. It wasn't like this Technicolor, beautiful wizardry.
Well, when we would go on the Sunday nights and there'd be a triple feature, the first movie would often start at like 6 when it was still light outside. So the first movie, you were just squinting the whole time saying, I can see some things, but I don't know if is that a guy or a horse? I don't know what I'm looking at. So it wasn't until like the middle of the second movie that it got dark enough to really fully enjoy the movie. But something magical about the experience of going to the concession stand, about like that commercial we just played, the come out to the lobby, like all that stuff that they'd show in between the movies was just so great. You know, there was a hot dog bun opening itself up to a hot dog jumping in. So erotic when you're a kid, when you're a little kid.
You didn't think
of it as
eroticism.
Whatever's going on here, this is amazing.
You were not that advanced as a kid.
There was a Coke with a straw that kept stirring around, and everybody was dancing. They were doing that kind of weird dancing that cartoons do. Oh, I loved it.
Bill, someone has texted in, the other drive-in was the Hilltop. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Hilltop. The I-80 and the Bel Air were the three that we usually went to.
I don't think they had one. I grew up in Brookfield. There might have been one in Cicero.
There was one fairly close to you. Well, the Bel Air wasn't that far from you.
Was that in the Chicago proper?
That was the one kind of near Ford City.
See, we didn't journey into the city. I am such a 708er, it's not even funny. We would go the other way. I thought Chicago was just the loop.
That was it.
I didn't know that, like, Harlem and Archer is...
Oh, yeah, it's still Chicago.
Yeah, I didn't really have any idea. Yeah.
Was there an urge for you to go? Because, like, we were so... Like, just knowing, Sunday's 3 days away, we're going to go see three movies.
I don't think I knew that they existed.
Oh, really?
We grew up in Brookfield. We had the zoo. That's all we did.
Yeah. I was always amazed at how many people would drive away. You know, you'd hook the speaker up to your window... This just horrible sound system. This metal box, and you'd roll your window down a little. You'd put the speaker in, you'd roll your window up.
Right.
And then they would warn you constantly before, during, and after the movies, do not drive away with the speaker in your door, please.
Anybody do that?
Oh, always. You saw it every week. People would do it.
The Bel Air was on 31st and Cicero Avenue.
Yeah.
I guess that's
now,
close.
Now, I think that was the one... When I was a kid, there was one where you would drive, when you would enter into the drive-in, you would pay, you'd get a little lollipop with a safety stick on it. It wasn't the regular.
Oh, the loop.
It was the looped one, so you wouldn't swallow it. And then you would drive through the screen, underneath the screen, like there were two drive-ins back-to-back, and your car would drive underneath the screens. And to me, that was like...
Cool.
You know when the Millennium Falcon goes into hyperspace? That's what it felt like driving through the screens. You're like, well, this is something. Driving through the movies.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Someone said that there was, in fact, a drive-in at Joliet Road in LaGrange or Countryside.
Oh, yes, there was.
Joliet Road in Countryside. It was called the 66 Drive-In.
Yeah.
My family never took me.
You never went?
I didn't go to Bozo. I didn't go to a drive-in.
I'm not sure your parents loved you.
I know you've said that
this
before.
It's horrible to admit, but I'm sure they liked you, but they should have taken you to a drive-in. That's crazy.
There was a drive-in on the southwest side, Harlem Avenue, where Haunted Trails was, so
I think that's I think they're talking about Bel Air there, I think.
The other one was on Southwest Highway, back in the 70s, and there was another one on Cicero Avenue around 31st. So those are the three you frequented?
Yeah. The back of the screen at the I-80 had, remember in the 70s, that logo that said love, but it was in very 70s-looking script?
Like
the L,
bubbly cursive?
Yeah, the L and the O were in the upper part. So that they had that painted on the back of it. I also remember, like, sometimes during the summer, you'd be driving somewhere, and you could see off in the distance, you'd see a movie screen, and they'd be showing a movie, so you'd only get, you know, a minute and a half of the movie.
But it was still exciting.
It was so great to watch that while you were driving.
All right, Steve wants to talk drive-ins. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Wendy. Yeah, do you remember Sky High Twin Theater? It was on 53 and 64. and it had the concession stand in the middle and two screens facing each other.
What town was this?
That would have been like Villa Park area, Lombard.
You don't remember that at all?
My family never took
me.
Yeah, that was a big theater. That was pretty cool.
Steve, would your parents have taken Wendy, do you think, if you had asked nicely? Do you think you
now, wait a minute. Did you go?
I've been going since I was probably 5 years old.
Oh,
we went
yeah.
to drive-ins. But I grew up in West Chicago, so we had Cascade. We used to just park on the side of the street and watch movies.
Right.
Because you could pick up the broadcast on the radio.
Oh, yeah, because you could turn your... I only went once. I'm serious. It was someplace like in Glenview or something. Up north, and it must have been... It was when Waterworld came out. That was the first and only time I went to a drive-in.
That was it.
And I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there was the one in Elgin on 20, and then they ended up going to X-rated films there.
Oh. That's interesting if you're driving past.
Yeah, drive-in, yes. Yeah, very unusual.
How did that work? I mean, I know how it works.
I have no idea. But I remember they had it there right off the
at the highway over there. Instead of speeding tickets, they gave tickets for drivers going too slowly.
Yeah.
People be going 5 miles an hour on the highway.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for the memories. I have none, Steve.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
That's all right. And somebody pointed out, and this is really true, I grew up in Brookfield. I live in LaGrange now.
Yeah.
The LaGrange Theater was there. So we went to the LaGrange Theater all the time.
That solved all your movie needs.
Yeah. So right. I guess... Thank you to the listener that pointed that out. That's why we didn't do drive-ins.
But you know, it's funny. In the summer, like when the drive-in was open, we would beg my parents to see the movies in a drive-in as opposed to a regular theater, even though the movie-going experience was far better inside, where it's a controlled environment, than outside. It was still such a spectacle to go and just, you know, we'd be in our station wagon. My dad had a mattress that he put up on top of the station wagon, and my brother and I would lay up on top of it and watch the movies. It was great.
You had the best parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to be jealous of the Brady Bunch. Now I'm jealous of the Lefts.
This is way better. All right, we'll take a break and then more discussion. One of the last drive-ins, the Cascade Drive-In, closing after 58 years in Chicago. Very, very sad. What are your thoughts and memories about drive-ins? We're 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Yeah, it's sad news, but the Cascade Drive-In in West Chicago is closing after 58 years. They were preparing for their season. It was set to open, and then news came that the screens will stay dark. The owners just announced this past Friday. The Cascade is one of the last of its kind in Chicagoland, really nationwide, really worldwide, and it's coming to a close. Very, very sad.
And Barbara wants to share some drive-in memories. How's it going, Barbara?
Real well. And with you guys?
Pretty
very good.
Good.
Thanks.
Listen, there's nothing like stuffing your car for buck night at the drive-in.
A dollar for how many movies? Two movies or maybe three?
Sometimes three, yeah.
Yeah, for a dollar a person or a dollar per car?
Dollar a car.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. So you'd go out and everybody'd have their buck, and then you'd have another buck to spend at whatever, and you could have a whole night entertainment.
Are these first run movies or older movies?
Well, it depends. Sometimes there's one first run and two old ones. So sometimes it would be horror night.
Yeah.
And they show like The Wolfman and Frankenstein, you know, and all the good ones. And or when you were in high school, you could see who was at the Passion Pit.
Yes.
Who was what?
At the Passion
Pit. At the Passion Pit.
Yep.
Is that what they called it?
Yes.
Was there an actual
section?
Sounds
like a barbecue place, doesn't it?
Well, no, you couldn't take a Nash Rambler because the seats went down.
Wow, you went a lot, didn't you, Barbara?
We did, I think, until I was about 16 or something.
Come on, Wendy, it's dollar night. What do you mean you can't stay away from that? Please.
My dollar night was different in high school. Barbara, we appreciate you sharing the memories. I wish I had some.
Oh, well, it's too bad, but take your family. Have a good time. Go do it sometime.
All right, thank you, Barbara. I better hurry because this is closed, right?
There's still one. Yeah, this one's already closed, the Cascade. I know there's still one in St. Charles. I pass by that one a couple of times a year, and I'm always intrigued. I see a double feature there, and I'm like, boy, it's such a long drive, but I would love to see a movie in a drive-in again. My kids have never seen a movie in a drive-in. I describe it to them, and they go, wait, so you sit in your car during the movie, and why? Why would you do that? Doesn't make sense.
It doesn't really make sense, but no. It was like this outing, this family outing.
Yeah.
And Passion Pit, is
that
was there a certain
section? Toward the back.
Yeah, I guess why would you sit in the front? You wouldn't want people looking
watching
at you.
It, yeah.
All right. Anne has a memory. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
What's your drive-in memory?
Well, it's actually not mine, but my son, who's now 25, when he was a senior in high school, we lived in Antioch, and they would go to the drive-in in Kenosha. And one night, they did the whole sneak-in thing where, like, four kids were under a blanket in the back of an SUV. And the cop was there and issued them all tickets for $350 apiece. Yeah, and it was for theft because they were stealing seeing the movie. And my son kept saying that the cop was apologizing to them, saying, I'm sorry, the manager calls us. And he wrote on the top of their tickets, very polite, very nice students. And when my son went to court, and he was outraged, and I had to keep telling him, well, you're stealing. You're stealing. I mean, I was upset with them. But he wanted to go to court by himself, and he went to court all dressed up, and they said to him, well, yeah, it's stealing. And the cop, the judge kind of laughed at him, and they reduced it to $65 and let them all go.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's
So, I mean, they've had a good relationship with the police, which I have to say, you know, the police have been pretty cool because you always hear about kids not liking police.
Sure.
But, yeah, I thought that was kind of funny that he got busted, you know.
That's wild.
And, he deserved it. He totally deserved it.
I remember at one of them, I want to say the I-80, there was a sign when you'd be paying that would say that anyone seeing the movie without paying would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And every once in a while, not often, but they would have somebody open their trunk to make sure that you weren't smuggling kids in to watch the movie.
Right. So apparently that's the fullest extent of the law, and they kind of laughed. They were like,
right.
Really? We got a bunch of 18-year-olds, and this is what they did? Whatever.
Yeah,
go ahead,
worse
go
things.
Home.
So funny. And thank you.
Yeah.
Have a great week.
Yeah, take care.
All right, does it say where was the Cascade? Because somebody's saying that's the one in St. Charles that you thought was still open, but everyone's texting saying we still have one in McHenry. McHenry is the one that's open. It's close to St. Charles. Someone else says West Chicago.
It doesn't give an address, but it says the Cascade is in West Chicago, but it does not give an address.
All right, well, look for the McHenry drive-in, because a lot of people are saying that there's still a drive-in in McHenry.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to have to get a little bed and breakfast there, too.
But
well, because it's a pretty long haul.
It's a long haul. Do you remember, though, that in the papers, in the Tribune and in the Sun-Times, where the movie listings were, now keep in mind, this was back when the movie listings sometimes were 4 or 5 pages long. There were so many movie theaters. It was a whole page that was all drive-ins.
I remember
it was the drive-in page. And now, you know, if anything, it takes up an inch in the newspaper. That's it.
That's it. I'm going to a drive-in this summer.
You would love it. I think your kids would love it. I thought my kids would love it, but they want no part of it. They're like, sit in a car for a whole movie? Why?
My kids will be playing their Switch
during
a movie.
The movie?
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break. We will continue more drive-in talk during the stream. If you want to join us on the stream, we'd love to have you there. That's coming up in just a little bit. Coming up, the stories that matter with Eric Rung from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio.